Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The 17th Annual Festival of Films in French is going on at UW-Milwaukee through Sunday. The festival features recent French-language films such as Paris, Manhattan, and French Immersion, and classics including the 1936 film La Grande Illusion and 1918's J'accuse. But it's a different French classic not showing this year that's on the mind of Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan. The Red Balloon came out in 1956. It's about a young boy who follows a mysterious and yet charismatic red balloon through a Paris neighborhood. Callanan published a recent essay on the real-life journey of the Red Balloon's director in the online magazine Medium, and he's with us now to share a bit of the backstory. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So we're talking about red balloons here. And as you were saying before we turned the microphones on, once you start thinking about red balloons, they are everywhere. But most recently, they were very obvious in the opening ceremonies of the Sochi Winter Olympics. There was a red balloon that was released. What got you thinking about red balloons? I assume the essay that we're talking about had been long in the works before the opening ceremonies came along.
It had been. It had been. And I should point out that the Russians did not consult me before the opening ceremonies, which their error, not mine. But it's my international portfolio increases with each passing month, and I guess this is another example of that. And I was actually quite taken with the opening ceremonies overall, but particularly that image of which involved a little girl who was kind of borne aloft by this red balloon. And the official media guide said it was to represent the end of communism. There was the red communism disappearing into the ether. And I thought, well, now wait a second. I've seen that red balloon before, and I also thought I have felt that experience before of being carried away by it. And this started, so a couple of years ago, I traveled to Paris and I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal about walking in the footsteps of different children's books in Paris, Hugo Cabret, the various Madeleine books. And then I briefly touched on The Red Balloon, which was actually a film before it was a book. But mid-1950s Paris, it was a very, very striking document. It was a boy following a very, very large, bright red balloon around a fairly gray and dingy Paris. And it's a short 34-minute film. Went on to win an Academy Award for Best Screenplay, even though there's hardly more than a dozen lines. And so in any case, I wrote up this article and I touched on it briefly, just a couple paragraphs. But then this balloon kept going. And I thought, there's more to this story. And then as I looked into it, indeed, there was. And so now I have a new essay, which is up on Medium. And it explores the path of that red balloon in some ways after it left Paris, because he turned out to be a fascinating, fascinating guy, the director.
Well, and to go back to the original movie and then book, the Red Balloon was highly symbolic, and it wasn't an especially happy movie. This was essentially a movie that got into the problems of kind of being different or thinking differently.
Absolutely. And it got into the problems of kind of a notion of hope, which I think made a lot of sense in what was still a very fresh post-war Paris. Other people have detected real Christian themes in the film. And in a more modern context, it really talks a lot about bullying. This boy and his coveted red balloon are chased all over Paris. And I think also relevant for me, it talked a lot about, you know, what is it like when something sticks to you in the story or in the film, it's that balloon sticks to the boy. But I found that the story I couldn't shake either. That's because this director, Albert Lamoureux, it was his son that was in the film, Pascal. And although he went on to do a variety of different things, he was never quite as successful as he was in that first film. And I just was so struck that he then later made a full-length feature film narrated by Jack Lemmon. It was called Stowaway in the Sky, which I think if Pixar's up, they may have wanted to look into this because it involves a grandfather and a young boy kind of being borne aloft by quite a few balloons. But when I kept kind of looking, I said, well, what an amazing story. What else did he go on to do? Well, he in fact did another final aerial film in which, of all places, Iran. So it's the late 1960s. And the Shah of Iran is looking for ways to make people think that the country has become a more modern place. And so he's talking with all sorts of filmmakers around the world, including Orson Welles, who even had a deal with the Shah to put together a film there. And he settles on Albert Lamoureux, and Albert says, fantastic. And he does this film based on the wind, which involves, again, flying all over Iran in this helicopter to see all these different places and to really kind of capture Iran for the eyes of the modern world.
This was not what the Shah had in mind, though.
Not so much. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous film. It's called The Lover's Wind. You can see it on YouTube. It's also linked to from the article. It's gorgeous. It's narrated by the wind, and I don't mean that poetically, or maybe I do, but because the wind is actually a character in the film that talks. And so it has long, lingering shots of these amazing moonscapes. I mean, for someone whose only images, and I would include myself in this, is of Iran is hostages bound in an overrun U.S. embassy, this was an amazing view of just a gorgeous, gorgeous country. But no, the Shah wanted computers. The Shah wanted
science.
He wanted beakers and test tubes and people in white coats. And he definitely wanted this hydroelectric marvel, which was a dam just north of Tehran. So
it sounds like what he really wanted was one of those industrial films talking up a corporation.
Exactly. That's exactly what he wanted. And so when Lamrice turned in this film, The Lover's Wind, the Shah was like, that's not it at all. You need to go back and you need to film this other stuff and you need to put it into the film. And you definitely need to get that dam. And Lamrice was saying, No, that's – in fact, the dam was one of the worst places to film because it's surrounded by power lines, and he knew enough about, I guess, balloons getting caught in things that he knew that he would probably get caught in that. And the Shah said, don't worry about it. In fact, I will give you my own personal helicopter pilot, and he will fly you around the dam to take shots. So they did this for a little while, and then sure enough, it got caught up in the power lines, and they crashed. And the family, Pascal and LaMaurice's wife – were not there, and they were devastated by this. They were apparently compensated for the loss, but they were overcome with the fact that not only had their father and husband died, but also the film was never seen because the Shah hated it so much. So 8 years later, the wife and Pascal, once again, he'd gone from holding a balloon to now editing a picture. They actually edited The Lover's Wind according to Dad's notes and put together this film that was so extraordinary. It actually, about 40 days after the Shah fled, Iran was nominated for an Academy Award. So it's a very striking document. But what struck me even more was when, with some forensic internet searching, I found this even more extraordinary film, which is only 7 minutes long, which is basically a series of clips that puts everything that the Shah wanted into one seven-minute document. And it appears to have been made by LaMaurice's Iranian crew, who also felt very bereft at the loss. And they put together this tiny little seven-minute film, and it's got everything. It's got beakers, and it's got test tubes, and it's got students walking around with calculators and books, and it has shots of that dam. And ever receding, the film is always pulling back away from the dam. And they put the dam at the very end of the clip as all they wanted the Shah to kind of feel worse and worse about it. But I guess what struck me most about that film, and when I really knew that I had something to write this essay about, is like 2.5 minutes in, this guy in a lab coat, he's like pouring something, it looks like really thin blood or Kool-Aid, into a test tube. And then, apropos of nothing, he ties a red balloon to the top of this giant glass stack and it starts to inflate. And I thought, someone put this together with an artist's eye.
And so it started with kind of a flip comment that once you start seeing red balloons, you see them everywhere. But in some ways, it seems like there is something more to the idea of seeing red balloons everywhere, that it's not just that you're seeing the image, but the point of the red balloon is recurrent in a lot of places.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the other things that I was so struck by, because I was looking – I was not able to make it to the Shah's Dam in order to report on the story, but I was able, with the help of the internet and image search, to find some modern-day pictures of it. And sure enough, the power lines around the dam had these giant red balls attached to them, which I know are not unique to that area, to warm pilots, but wow, they really look like red balloons. But like you say, I don't think it's so much that we're looking for those red, although you realize the brilliance of his choice in retrospect, because you really do notice red circles everywhere. But this notion of hope and a kind of an elegy for what's lost. I think one of the bravest things about that red balloon, spoiler alert for people who haven't seen it, is the way it lies crumpled on the ground at the very end. And there's another spoiler. There's a soaring moment where then Pascal takes off into the skies with hundreds of balloons of all these different colors. And I always felt that that moment at the very end of the film actually did feel a little bit tacked on or cheap, because to me it was that moment, that notion of loss and what you've lost and kind of what the arc of a life can be, and that it always ends a little bit too soon. And that certainly seems to be the case in the case of this director, who 35 years ago, as we were waiting to hear the news of the Academy Awards this season, would missed out on hearing news of his nomination.
Certainly a lot different than trying to cast Madeline books in these same ways.
Absolutely. I mean, those are children's. Again, these books were meant for kids and adults. But in the case of the Madeline books, those books are all fun. I mean, even when she plunges into the River Seine, she gets scooped out. Things are going to be okay. But in the case of the Red Balloon, even though we end on that feeling of hope, there's still this notion of elegy and loss, like what is being lost. And I think in some ways that's kind of an interesting comment on the film too, because the neighborhood in which the film was shot has also been lost, as I talk about in the essay. It was in a slum clearance program, mostly disappeared, and now is a fairly pretty terraced green park. But you lose all those kind of little winding roads, and it's a lot harder to get tie a balloon to a lamppost when it's missing, which sounds like a euphemism.
It does. I was just going to say. And on that note, Liam, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me in.
Novelist and UWM English professor Liam Callanan's essay, In Paris, Tracing the Path of the Red Balloon, is published in the online literary magazine Medium. There's a link from wuwm.com/lake effect. Another break now, and in just a moment, a major photography exhibit at the Hagerty Museum leads us to think about our roles as consumers. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.